This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to our new series, Elements of State Health Reform, a partnership with the National Governors Association. These interactive web shows look at the growing momentum for health reform in the states and probe the key issues policymakers are facing as they develop approaches to cover the uninsured and make health care more affordable. Today we are looking at state initiatives to require individuals or employers to pay for health insurance as a tool for expanding coverage. Many view an individual mandate as the only way to guarantee universal coverage. And with employers already covering the bulk of Americans, it is not surprising that some states are looking to business as a source of financing for expanded coverage. Yet such requirements have triggered opposition on both philosophical and fiscal grounds. And there is legal uncertainty over whether states are able, under the federal ERISA law, to impose financial requirements on employers related to health coverage. We're joined by a panel of state and national experts to look at various approaches for achieving universal or near universal coverage. Mike Smith is Secretary of Administration for the state of Vermont, which is aiming to cover at least 96% of the population through its Catamount Health Plan. Richard Figueroa is a healthcare advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and a longtime leader on health issues in Sacramento, where he's joining us by phone. And Phyllis Borzi is a research professor at George Washington University after serving for 16 years on Capitol Hill. She is widely recognized as one of the nation's top legal experts on ERISA. You can reach our panel by emailing your questions at any time during the show to ask@kaisernetwork.org. And thanks to all of you for joining us. And Mike Smith, who is joining us by phone from Vermont, let's start with you.
Okay.
So your aim is to get at universal or near universal coverage in Vermont, but not necessarily with an individual mandate. Go through the main elements or the main building blocks of getting to expanded coverage there.
Sure. When we looked at this, we sort of put this in a comprehensive package to look at how do you increase access or near, as you say, near universal access, how do we contain costs and how we improve quality. And although there's a lot of elements in the legislation that we passed to look at a comprehensive package, two of them I'd like to focus. One is called the Catamount Health Plan, which is a comprehensive health care plan that is based upon sort of an average comprehensive plan here in Vermont. And what we do, we finance it through several mechanisms, including increased cigarette tax, the employer assessment, and I'll get into that a little bit later, and premiums from the people who access this. In Vermont, we have basically just under 10% uninsured, so we have about 62,000. What we found is about half of those are eligible for Medicaid, so we're going to do an outreach program. The others, about half of those that are remaining, are between 150 to 300% federal poverty level, so we really focused in on there and devised an affordable plan with the revenues that I talked about, that really gives a comprehensive package. Now, we shied away from from the individual mandate, and let me tell you the reason why. We looked at it, and it's still an option if we don't get to 96% participation or people insured in Vermont. But when we looked at it, we thought, well, right now in Vermont, we have people who are required to have automobile insurance, and yet what we found was that we have about a 10% non-participation rate or non-coverage rate with automobile insurance. Even though we have a mandated requirement to have automobile insurance, people, we still don't have everybody that does it. So we wanted to try sort of this way of an outreach program to capture those people. On the employer assessment, basically, what it says is that if you don't cover employees, then you're assessed a buck a day, about $365 a year for each employee that you don't have coverage for. So that, in a nutshell, is what we have done in Vermont, and that's really quickly a real quick snapshot, focusing on the two areas that you talked about.
And let me come back to the individual mandate. So you don't require people to buy coverage, but you do have subsidies to make it more affordable for those folks up to 300% of poverty.
That's exactly right. And there's two types of subsidies that we do have. You're subsidized depending on your income from basically 150 to 300%. We have expanded Medicaid here in Vermont. So the target population we were trying to get at is above that expanded Medicaid population that we have here, from 150 to 300%. So so we have incentives and pretty good incentives in order to, if you're uninsured, to join Catamount Health in terms of premium assistance. We also have premium assistance that if you have access to your employer-sponsored insurance, we will subsidize that as well if you're uninsured right now and need assistance to get onto your employer-sponsored insurance. We make the calculation, which is cheaper for the state, for you to be on the employer-sponsored insurance as long as it's a similar coverage or the Catamount Health plan.
And to you, I mean, one of the arguments people make for an individual mandate is that it allows you to do insurance market reforms. It allows you to require insurers to guarantee issue coverage, to do so without health status rating. And you have those insurance market rules in place in Vermont. Are there any concerns that it'll be difficult to sustain them without an individual mandate?
We don't think so. But again, we have this provision in our law that in 2010 we'll revisit this to see where we are with the participation rate and see what needs to be adjusted, including looking at the individual mandate. But right now we think the approach and the subsidies that we're providing, for example, if you're right around the 150% poverty rate, federal poverty rate, we're estimating that your premium will be about $60 a month.
Got it. And you mentioned the employer assessment as part of the financing, a dollar a day or about $365 a year. And that's obviously substantially less than the cost of insurance. I mean, a small fraction of the cost of insurance. So this wasn't meant to give employers an inducement to offer coverage, but more to get some money into the system.
Yeah, it was more dealing with how are we going to fund a system, and we looked at several ways that we were going to fund this system. I mean, quite frankly, we had another healthcare bill a year prior that had a payroll tax on it, and we rejected this as an administration. We rejected it, and the reason we rejected it is because it punished good behavior. If you were providing insurance, you still got taxed. Under this new sort of assessment, if you're not providing insurance, you get assessed. So it rewards good behavior. It asks employers to do the right thing. And also, what we found is that if we are going to, we also exempted employers over a time period. Starts out with 8 FTEs or less, then it goes down to 6 over the next couple of years, and then it goes down to 4 where we will exempt really small operations from the requirements here.
Let me bring Richard Figueroa from California into this. And Richard, you, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed a plan earlier this year that has some similarities to Vermont but some key differences as well. Go through quickly the building blocks, how you get to universal coverage, which is what the governor has proposed.
Great. Thanks, Larry. Basically, the governor's plan has 3 main elements, the first being prevention and wellness, looking at just making health promotion, disease prevention, and wellness a priority, with both short-term and longer-term payoffs. The second element is coverage for all, and within that we have what we call shared benefits and shared responsibilities between individuals, government, doctors and hospitals, health plan, and employers. And the third kind of key element is affordability, knowing that over the long term, in order to sustain the healthcare system, we're going to have to do something to lower the large increases we're seeing on the cost side. Specifically on the coverage for all, we have about 6.5 million folks that are uninsured at some point during the year, and in any given month, about 4.8 million folks that are uninsured. And we are proposing to expand coverage through the individual mandate, but much as Vermont and Massachusetts have and other states have undertaken, to do so in a way that provides subsidies for lower-income individuals. So we're going to be expanding our Medicaid, or Medi-Cal, as we call it here in California, program to cover all persons under 100% of the federal poverty level, and then have kind of a purchasing pool above that in terms of persons between 100 and 250% of the federal poverty level, and that's about 1.2 million folks be eligible for that. And then above the subsidy level, that's kind of where the guarantee issue, the individual mandate starts to really kick in terms of people having to purchase in an unsubsidized manner, and there'll be about a million or so folks that will be purchasing, we expect, or opting for employer-sponsored coverage without a subsidy. We basically decided, you know, on the individual mandate, because for us at least it was the most effective way to achieve, you know, universal coverage. Without it, we believe people will continue to voluntarily forgo coverage and therefore shift uncompensated costs to insured individuals. We call that the hidden tax. We believe it's about 17 cents on every premium dollar is part of the hidden tax. A good portion of that, 10 cents or so of that 17 cents, are associated with folks that voluntarily forego coverage or otherwise can't afford it. The other 7 cents being our dramatic rate of underpayment in terms of our Medicaid program. And so part of what we're trying to do here is increase our Medicaid reimbursement at the same time, so that everyone isn't bearing the cost of that. We are asking individuals to pay, even for the subsidized portion, either 3, 4, or 6% of their gross family income. And then for folks in the subject to the individual mandate, we are endeavoring, much as Massachusetts did, to set a minimum mandated benefit at a level that's reasonable. For us, we think it's about $100 on average for the average uninsured person, which is probably an uninsured person between 30 and 34 years old. So that's kind of how we've set those price points. We are asking employers to pay some as well, and we've exempted employers below 10 employees from what we're calling a 4% employer fee, which is basically 4% of Social Security payroll. We believe that employer-sponsored coverage has been an important part of our healthcare system since World War II and will continue to be an important core element of any system of universal coverage. The 4% of Social Security payroll is basically going to go into a special state fund to help subsidize lower-wage employees, and beyond just being a necessary financial component to our overall cost of funding universal coverage program. It also kind of helps to some extent level the playing field between offering and non-offering employers, because we don't want to have elements in our plan that provide incentives for employers to drop coverage.
Let me follow up on that 4%. And it's 4% of payroll, so just for sake of an example, if an employer has an average wage of, let's say, $30,000, so that's $1,200 per employee, which is substantially more than what Massachusetts and Vermont have enacted, but still less than the typical cost of insurance in the marketplace today. How did you arrive at that 4% number?
The 4%, it isn't exactly a pay-or-play kind of situation, because that 4% is going to go into a special fund that just subsidizes low-wage workers. It was more recognition of trying to level the playing field a little bit, and not making it so high that would drive businesses from the state or otherwise invite ERISA challenges, which I know Ms. Borzi is going to talk about a little bit. It's more recognition that they had a role to play if they were a non-offering employer, and at the same time trying to set it high enough that employers were not going to, you know, drop coverage. And the way we've kind of set this, just to give you an idea, is an employer, if they have to pay 4%, if they have all low-wage workers that would be eligible for the subsidy, yes, that may be an enticement for them. But for the regular, you know, the average employer that has a wide range of individuals employed in that, if they were to drop coverage in favor of the 4%, those higher-wage individuals would then be kind of be on their own and purchasing coverage in the private individual market. Their low-wage workers, albeit eligible for a subsidy, would still be paying 3, 4, or 6% of their gross family income, which is higher than many of them pay right now as their share of employer-sponsored coverage. So if an employer were to drop coverage in favor of the 4%, they're exposing both their middle to high, you know, income wage earners to go basically purchasing coverage on their own, and even their lower wage earners from paying more than they probably do right now for employer-sponsored coverage. So that employer is not going to be very popular with their employees, and again, you know, most employers do offer it even now in a voluntary market. So we are very careful to set it at a rate where we didn't think we really would be enticing employers to drop coverage in favor of just paying the 4%.
And let me ask you more about the individual mandate. First, also part of the governor's plan is a substantial set of insurance market reforms that guarantee access to coverage, eliminate health status rating among individuals. And was the individual mandate key in your thinking to being able to do that?
Correct. As we indicated before, you know, shared benefits, shared responsibility, and on the insurer side, yes, they will have, you know, millions of more insured lives to which to market to and receive those revenues, but they have a responsibility as well, and that is to do, you know, guarantee issue. We really didn't believe that you can't have an individual mandate and then not have a place for people to go, and we believe that choice is an important feature of the individual mandate, and so have suggested as part of our proposal that it be, you know, an all products guarantee. We also are suggesting that insurers not be allowed to vary their premium rates other than based on age, family size, and geography. So there wouldn't be any, not only would not there be medical underwriting, there wouldn't be rate bands or things like that associated with the individual medical risk of an individual.
Well, I want to bring Phyllis in here a little bit, hopefully not to put too much of a damper on things. And Phyllis, let's start off with some basics about ERISA. And first, what, in your view, does ERISA clearly allow states to do? There's little dispute about it in the legal community.
Well, I think the thing that clearly states could do, whether or not there's the political will to do it or not, is states could impose a broad-based fee or tax on all employers. That's clearly not preempted by ERISA, because ERISA only preempts state laws that relate to an employee benefit plan. So requirements on employers that aren't specifically mandates to provide plans or specific benefits are not preempted by ERISA. But it's a continuum, as you suggest, as your question suggests. And the problem with this broad-based tax or fee is that's the no good deed goes unpunished, the government version of it.
So even employers who provided coverage.
Exactly. So what states who want to create broad-based programs with an employer financing component, because that makes perfect sense from a policy and financial point of view, what they've been trying to do is craft ways to create credits against the fee or tax for employers who provide plans. And whether you go all the way to a pay or play program or something along the lines that the governor is proposing in California, the difficulty, it seems to me, is, again, because it's a continuum, you want to have the fee or the tax not create an incentive or not be able to be characterized as something that forces employers to provide plans, or not to create the kind of incentives that the governor in California is concerned about and all the other governors are concerned about, which is for employers to drop their plans.
And in terms of forcing or requiring employers to create a plan or offer
right.
coverage, that's an area that there's broad consensus would clearly not be permitted under
ERISA. Even the Supreme Court in the Travelers case, which was a 1995 case that marked a turning point in the ERISA jurisprudence, even in that case, the Supreme Court unanimously went out of its way to say that if you mandate benefits or benefit structures or interfere with plan administration, it's going to be preempted by ERISA.
Now, there's some confusion around, because states do have historically mandated certain benefits in insurance
right.
plans, whether it's maternity coverage or mental health coverage.
Right.
And explain how that's done, why that's okay.
The reason it can be done is because ERISA really has... I'm going to try not to sound like a law professor here, but ERISA really, the preemption clause of ERISA has three parts. The broad rule that says any state law that relates to employee benefit plan is preempted. And the Travelers case and the kinds of things we're talking about today really deal with when a law relates to an employee benefit plan. The second part is an exemption, because every good law has an exemption. And it's an exemption for various kinds of state laws, including state insurance laws. And the third part is an exemption from the exemption, because goodness knows legislatures can't possibly do simple things. And that's the Deamer Clause, that you can't call employee benefit plans insurance insurers in order to get it out from under the basic relates to test. The mandated benefit cases fall under the Insurance Savings Clause, the part of ERISA that says, if you've got a law regulating insurance, it's not preempted by ERISA. And that's why the key part of your question was that these are rules that can be imposed on insurers, not on ERISA plans generally.
So they have for employers that buy insurance
right.
on the open market, they have the indirect effect of making sure that coverage has those mandated benefits.
Yeah, if you think about it this way, ERISA applies to all employer plans, whether they're insured or self-insured. But employers who decide to purchase coverage for their employees through an insured arrangement are also indirectly subject to a second level of regulation, and that's because the states can regulate the product they buy, not the plan that they offer, but the product they buy.
But if an employer is self-funding, not purchasing insurance,
right.
then the mandates don't apply. And let's come back to this the pay-or-play idea, the idea that a state might try to create a system where employers either provide coverage or, in effect, pay some assessment or fee. Thinking about that kind of approach, what are some things, recognizing there are no guarantees, what are some things some states could do or should avoid doing in order to protect those types of plans under ERISA?
Let me focus on the things I think they should avoid doing, because this, I'll say another time, it's a continuum. If a state does a pay-or-play approach, you want to avoid either the pay part or the pay part, either prong. You want to avoid either of those prongs being characterized as forcing an employer to have a plan. So let's start with the more obvious, the play part. What you want to do is you want to say an employer can either pay a tax or a fee. If I use tax, I also mean fee. So they can pay a sum of money or they can provide coverage. Well, what you don't want to do in describing the coverage that they have to provide to avoid paying the fee or the tax is you don't want to be very prescriptive. You don't want to define the parameters of coverage. What you don't want to say, it's surely going to be preempted, I think, if you say you have to provide this package of benefits, you can only provide family coverage, you can't charge more than 20%. The more bells and whistles that you put on the play component, the more likely it is that a court will find that you're forcing an employer to have a plan that looks a certain way. That's really what you're going to try to avoid. Now, on the pay part, you might say to yourself, well, wait a minute, this woman started by saying it's perfectly okay to impose a tax or fee. So why would that be a problem? Well, the problem in structuring the pay part of this arrangement is if you tie the payment to coverage in a pool, a public pool, or some other mechanism to the fee that employee pays for the employees. In other words, here, let me give you an example. Suppose you say, suppose California, now this isn't what I hear that the governor's plan does, but suppose a mythical state was to say, we're going to charge, employers will have to pay 4%. And that money is used on behalf of their employees to buy coverage for their employees in a pool. Well, even though you're imposing a requirement to pay, it's still an arrangement with respect to that employer's employees. So you could make an argument. Opponents of this arrangement would certainly argue that in that case, even the pay component was forcing employers to have a plan. Because under ERISA, you have a plan when you have an arrangement in which you establish or maintain coverage for your employees. So this is all about drafting and the way you've conceptualized, the state conceptualizes its program.
And the way Richard Figueroa described the governor's plan, which is employers, or the Vermont plan for that matter, where employers are paying an assessment, but that money is not necessarily attached
it's
to that.
It's not tied to their employees. I think that's... that's more likely than not to not be preempted. Again, there's no guarantees.
And Richard Figueroa, let me come back to you. If not for ERISA, do you think, did ERISA play a major role in the design of the governor's plan?
I believe it did, and I think we are a mythical state, Larry.
In fact,
we were very cognizant of, we had a pay-or-play bill a couple of years ago, called Senate Bill 2, which it was passed and signed by the previous governor, but then was referendized out of existence. It was very clear that that bill was going to be challenged on an ERISA basis, and because, you know, this governor was mindful of you know, some of the issues around around ERISA. We were watching closely the court decision in Maryland, and certainly the governor didn't want to be in a situation where, you know, if we were able to reach agreement with the legislature, would be immediately challenged in court and would have to, you know, take several years to wind its way through the courts, and there'd be some kind of, you know, potentially Supreme Court decision on all of this. So he was very careful in designing this in a way that we believe would not, you know, fail or the ERISA test, or pass the ERISA test, I should say, in order that we have something that is actually implementable in the longer or in the short term and not have to worry about some court case in the longer term.
I want to move on to some of the questions we've been getting by email, and start out with a very broad one, which raises, I mean, all of these plans that we're talking about here are predicated on private coverage, whether that's employers providing coverage to their workers, coverage through a purchasing pool, or expansions in public programs like Medicaid. And the question is, what about single payer? And Mike Smith, in Vermont, I mean, there is some history of a debate over single payer there. Is that still alive? Was that a consideration in designing the Catamount Health Plan?
Well, that was a huge debate here. Whether we should go to single payer or, as the governor wanted to do, is integrate the private market. In Vermont, we were, at least from our perspective, we were a little leery of going single payer on our own. We thought we would, we've done well in sort of erasing it, a fairly significant Medicaid deficit in the past. What we saw if we went to single payer, that this thing could be a Medicaid on steroids in terms of the deficit. We thought there would be an influx into the state. It could swamp the system from our perspective. The other thing that was really, how do you pay for a single payer? And the mechanism is the income tax, which is the easiest mechanism here in Vermont. And we already, California may beat us by a little bit, but the highest marginal rate, we're either second or first, I can't remember, with California. We got the highest marginal rate for income tax in the country. So there is this ongoing debate, but what we did, there was a big push in the legislature for a single payer. What we decided to do was compromise with this hybrid sort of plan. Between and use the private market and use a subsidy within the private market. For example, we will be pretty soon the plans will come in now, and there's prescribed comprehensive coverage in the plans. Plans will be submitted to our banking and insurance department here soon on those costs to those plans. We're estimating it to be about $360-$365 a month with comprehensive coverage, and then we can subsidize off that for those people who don't have insurance can go directly to Catamount Health, and for those who have substantial equivalent plans in the ESI, we can subsidize from there. So we think we've reached a good compromise here with a viable funding source that doesn't we just recently got AAA here in the state of Vermont, that doesn't sort of compromise our financial underpinnings and go with something that we're fairly certain with that sort of melds brings in both the private sector with sort of the public subsidy aspect here and really sort of gets to where we want to go, which is our target of 96% coverage.
You know, there are actually some ERISA problems with single payer. I know this seems counterintuitive, but there are at least two arguments that I've heard raised about potential ERISA problems with single payer arrangements in the states. The first being the one that I talked about a minute ago with the tax. If you finance a single payer, in part through an employer tax, there is a question as to whether or not, depending on how it was drafted, you'd have to decouple the payment of the tax or fee from coverage that an employer's employees take. But the more interesting, I think, ERISA argument that I've heard is that a single-payer plan would displace employer coverage, and therefore that might be a law that related to ERISA plans, not because you forced a company to have a plan, but because you required coverage through a single-payer program that therefore had some form of displacement or effect on an ERISA plan.
And ERISA in that sense is very broad. I mean, ERISA doesn't actually say you can't require an employer to do anything. It just talks about relating to it.
You can't require them to do something with a plan.
Right. And Richard, you're in a different situation in California since the governor's plan as a proposal hasn't been enacted. And there is still a live single-payer proposal as well in California. How do you see that playing in the debate?
Well, as you note, you know, we do have a bill pending in our legislature related to single payer. The governor actually vetoed a single payer bill in 2006. We have a almost unique fiscal requirements in California to pass something like single payer, or really any bill that relates to the budget or has a fiscal impact. We in our legislature have a two-thirds requirement to pass any bills that would appropriate dollars, and neither party in California has a two-thirds majority. So requiring or passing a single-payer bill that actually had the funding to implement it, and it would be very, very difficult in our legislature. So people have looked at this more about in terms of, gee, will there be some ballot proposition or ballot initiative, which we are also very famous for, coming down the road to enact something like this, because such a thing would not pass our legislature, at least with funding in it. So the bill the governor vetoed last year was had more the structure of single payer, but not the funding for single payer. Governor Schwarzenegger does not support single payer. He believes it's a government-run, you know, basically takeover of the system. That's something that he's not comfortable with. But much like Vermont, believes that kind of the shared benefits, shared responsibility model is one that's more acceptable and builds on the existing framework, and people wouldn't believe that they're going to be, you know, have their current systems of care disrupted in favor of more of a government organized and sponsored delivery system.
And we have Mike Smith had talked earlier about some of the fiscal pressures that existed in public programs like Medicaid previously, and we have another question by email. Which asks, in plans like this, what happens to funds in established, existing state programs? And Richard, let me stay with you. In the governor's plan, there are a lot of programs in California already providing coverage or access to care for the uninsured. What happens to those? What would happen to those under the governor's proposal?
Well, under the governor's proposal, we're basically trying to build on what we have. We have, for example, you know, obviously a very large and vibrant, you know, Medicaid program, which covers about 6 million Californians. We basically would be adding about 1 million to that. We have an SCHIP program here called Healthy Families, which basically runs like a purchasing pool. We'd be adding an adjunct for adults onto our existing construct for SCHIP, so that you know, the parents of those SCHIP children, as well as other single individuals that don't have children that are in the income range I discussed earlier, that 100 to 250% of the federal poverty level group, would have access to, you know, what basically looks like, you know, private insurance coverage through a purchasing pool model. So obviously we want to utilize every federal dollar we can in expanding, you know, through Medicaid funding mechanisms or otherwise, you know, more coverage to individuals. There would be things like our high-risk pool, for example, which would not exist under the model we're talking about, because when you have guarantee issuance and other sorts of subsidies, you wouldn't need, you know, a high-risk pool for uninsurable individuals, because there would be no more uninsurable individuals under guarantee issue. So some things would go away. We also have a large funding state-county partnership where we give flow billions of dollars to them to take care of, you know, the uninsured and undocumented, et cetera, and there'd have to be some adjustments in that program as well. So we're not, you know, we're trying to make better use of the dollars we have, bring down federal dollars, emphasize primary and preventive services to kind of help keep costs down. We're also trying to, where there are kind of little niche programs that have coverage, specialized coverage programs for children in one income category but not another, or split families between public programs, we're also endeavoring to combine those families in a way that makes sense so they all can be seeing the same provider and have the same health plan versus these little niche kind of things that we've developed. So we are trying to develop quote-unquote bright lines between our different programs so that, you know, all kids above a certain percent of the federal poverty level are joined together in one program, and adults, you know, can be joined together with the rest of the family, et cetera, and taking this opportunity to kind of make more sense of our currently pretty fractured system of financing.
And Richard, you mentioned earlier this idea of the hidden tax, that having Medicaid or Medi-Cal rates that are below private rates right now, and having a large uninsured population in California, those costs end up getting shifted to other payers. And so your expectation is that universal coverage would eliminate or mitigate that hidden tax and create savings for presumably mostly employers now who provide coverage?
That's correct. We think employers are, you know, right now, employees and employees really, through higher copays, deductibles, and premiums, are bearing about a $15 billion burden associated with folks that voluntarily forgo coverage, can't afford it, as well as our underpayment of Medi-Cal. So one of our biggest cost containment, so to speak, features or elements of the plan is trying to eliminate or drastically reduce the hidden tax. Just today, Governor Schwarzenegger, as we speak, is visiting an emergency room in San Diego County. That particular hospital has about a $50 million burden every year that they have to pass along to everyone else because they see so many uninsured. And this is one thing that the employer community in California has been able to get behind in terms of being, you know, because we've highlighted the large hidden tax that they are bearing as part of this. And so they've been very supportive of increasing our, you know, payments to our Medicaid providers and in looking for ways to reduce the number of uninsured because they, in fact, realize they do bear that burden. And that has resonated very well in the California populace once they understand, gee, this isn't just an issue of the uninsured, you know, in a vacuum. I am paying as well. And so of all the things that we've done, people get shared benefits, they get the share, they get shared responsibility, and they also have been very supportive of the notion of, gee, this is a hidden tax, and we all got to get in this together and try to figure out how to fix it.
And Mike Smith, Richard mentioned making use of or maximizing federal funds as part of a health reform plan. What role did that play in Vermont?
Quite a bit. I mean, first of all, like Richard, Vermont has a very expansive Medicaid program right now, and we have expanded our Medicaid program as far as it can go. For example, we have about 14.5% of our population on Medicaid right now, up to 150%. And what we would do is go from 150 to 300% in this area, and use, we have what is called a global commitment to health. We have one of the first in the nation sort of 1115 waiver, which gives us enormous flexibility in how we can use Medicaid dollars. In return, we have agreed to a rate of adjustment each year that's lower than our traditional growth rate, but still we think we can maintain our programs under that. But it gives us enough flexibility. We're in for another waiver here to use some of our Medicaid in that expanded population from 150 to 300. One thing Richard said that is critical here, and I'll just go back for a minute. The employers really got this. And they got the fact that if you insure people, and that if you can reduce the uncompensated care, that helps them. I mean, it may not be dollar for dollar, but theoretically, they knew in intellectually that helps them, and that helped us out a lot as we were putting this together, because they knew that somehow in their premiums there was a cost shift charge, and what they wanted to do is say, as we try to reduce costs for everyone, how do we do that? And quite frankly, the employers stepped up to the plate here and said, "Yeah, this makes sense." And that was a big selling point as we moved forward.
And Richard, are you finding in California, has there been, have you found some employer support for the plan?
Yeah, I mean, as indicated earlier, I mean, I think the idea of eliminating the hidden tax has really resonated with employers. Our strong interest in increasing prevention and wellness packages that are available to them, like we call healthy rewards, healthy incentives programs, has resonated with them. You know, basically things that would help them urge their employees to take some personal responsibility for their health has resonated with them. When you get into things like the 4% fee, depending on whether you're an offering employer, non-offering employer, and how much you're actually spending, there's, you know, we've had variable views expressed on, gee, it ought to be more, it ought to be less, I can't afford anything, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So on that, as soon as you get to like the dollar figure amount, and it's 4% high, too high or too low, employers and employer groups are kind of all over the map on that one. But again, you know, on some of the basic issues of shared benefits, shared responsibility, that resonates well on issues of prevention and wellness, and really trying to, gee, what can we do to lower that hidden tax, because they know they're paying it. They get it. And you know, the health plans are not very shy about saying, hey, you got to pay these, we have to pass these bills on to you. And certainly doctors and hospitals are not shy about saying, hey, I got to keep my lights on. I got to pay, you know, I got to pay my nurses. I have to keep my computers running. I have, you know, a lot of costs of doing business. They're not shy about saying they have to pass those along either, because at the end of the day, they have to, you know, balance their own balance books at the end.
Right. I want to get back to our emails, and we have an email from out in California asking about ideas or suggestions for how local jurisdictions might extend authority to require and or encourage employer participation in the provision of health insurance. And Phyllis, let me start with you. First, just basics. ERISA, this isn't just a state issue. I mean, presumably ERISA applies to local governments as well.
That's true. I mean, ERISA defines state law broadly, but presumably it would apply in local governments. But one thing I would caution the local governments, city governments, whatever, is remember back to what your initial question to me, what is likely not to be preempted, there's consensus is not preempted, is a tax. So if the jurisdiction doesn't have, and I understand, I'm not an expert in all the state laws, but if there's no taxing authority that the jurisdiction has, it has to be a tad more creative in trying to figure out how to get the employers involved in the financing component.
And has there been a couple cities that have tried to...
A couple of cities, and actually there's RILA, the Retail Industry Leaders Association, that... sued successfully to strike down the Maryland law, also sued Suffolk County, New York. There's a case, a lawsuit going on there where the county did a similar thing, slightly different approach. They did it structured like a minimum wage, that a certain percentage of the hourly wage had to go to health, but similar kind of approach, and that's being challenged in court.
And this Maryland law, so the Maryland law applied only to Walmart, to one employer in the state. And
although you didn't find that on the face of the law, it applied to employers with 10,000 or more employees in the state of Maryland. But as a practical matter, the only one, it applied to all these employers, but the only one that it would have had an impact on would have been Walmart. At least that was the allegation.
And it would have set a minimum threshold for the percent of payroll that...
Yeah, interestingly enough, the Maryland law was as clean as you could possibly want it in structure. But I think when the court, if you look at both the district court and the circuit court opinion, what clearly was offensive to the court is in operation it only affected one employer, and that wasn't broad-based enough to survive.
And the Maryland law is dead at this point.
That particular law, yeah. But Maryland, like many of the other states, are looking at more broad proposals. However, the legislature, being a Maryland citizen, I can tell that the legislature just adjourned without addressing this issue in a more comprehensive fashion in this legislative session.
And do you expect, I mean, there is the Vermont assessment on the books, the Massachusetts assessment on the books. Do you expect, are there cases underway challenging those, or would you expect those?
As far as I know, there's there's nothing, there's no case. Mike is probably in a better position than I to talk about Vermont. I know there's no case in Massachusetts. I know that San Francisco was one of the jurisdictions that did an employer assessment, and I heard at a program that I attended, although I don't know for sure, that the San Francisco assessment on employers is being challenged as well.
And Mike Smith, how much of an issue did ERISA play in the discussions there? Have you had any threats or legal challenges?
No, we haven't. We haven't had any legal challenges. And we sort of did it a little bit differently than California, but in the end it all came out sort of in where we needed to be. We looked at those three elements that we talked about, you know, quality of care, accessibility to insurance, and cost containment. And we designed the program first around that. I mean, we got the blueprint for health in terms of cost containment. How do we go after those chronic diseases and those sort of things? And then we had the insurance piece, and how do we fit the insurance pieces in? And when we got to that design, then we started looking at the financing, and then we started looking at ERISA sort of at the back end after we sort of have looked at all the components of what we were trying to do. And when we looked at ERISA, we were fairly comfortable that overall, it's a funding source that's, not a mechanism intended to be or, likely to affect, any employer's decision on whether to offer, coverage or a type of coverage. And specifically, there's nothing in our law that dictates that employees offer coverage or anything about the coverage offered by employees. The law is neutral about whether employers choose to offer coverage or pay the assessment. It does not contain any areas of regulation that are contained in ERISA, and it does not regulate ERISA plans, benefits, and those things. And quite frankly, the 9125 quarterly assessment for each full-time equivalent does not, in our opinion, does not meet the standard for imposing substantial costs. So we sort of looked at what do we want to do, how do we want to fund it, and then does it meet ERISA in that way.
Well, I think we have time for one more email, and this is a question about federally qualified health centers and their role in employer individual coverage expansions, and these are certainly places where many of the current uninsured get care. Richard Figueroa, let me come to you. What do you expect to happen with those kinds of traditional providers under the governor's plan?
Well, you know, as part of our shared benefits, shared responsibility, one thing I hadn't touched on before is that we are assessing a fee on all physicians in the state, equal to 2% of their gross patient revenue, and 4% on all hospitals in terms of their gross patient revenue. FQHCs are exempt from that under the way that the feds allow us to use those dollars to match their dollars to provide additional assistance to states. So that's kind of on the revenue side. They're also going to see hopefully a lot of folks that come in on sliding fee scale right now will now have a more stable reimbursement stream behind them, either through Medicaid or because they'll be enrolled in our purchasing pool. In our SCHIP program, for example, we give people in our SCHIP program a premium break if they enroll in a plan that we call the community provider plan. That's when they send the best job of including FQHCs, county hospitals, and other public providers in their provider, you know, roles. And I think we would expect the board that's going to be managing the purchasing pool to kind of do the same thing, to really encourage participating health plans and providers to enroll FQHCs and other public and not-for-profit entities in their provider systems. So I think, you know, they have an important role in California now. They will continue to have an important role. Their payer mix may change as a result of this. They will hopefully receive, additional resources. One of the things that is a little tricky about this is some FQHCs in California receive, you know, potentially a higher rate under what they call the prospective payment system than they would on private insurance plans. So there is that concern among FQHCs that's particular to California, but that may be also true of of other states, but generally I think we believe that all providers will benefit by having a lot more stable reimbursement systems than they have now, so they don't have to pass along the hidden costs, or in the case of FQHCs, have to rely on, you know, fundraising and additional federal grants and things like that to kind of carry them through at the end of the day.
And Mike Smith, what are you seeing issues in Vermont with changes in the marketplace where people are getting care, or do you expect those changes?
Well, in terms of FQHCs, we sort of they're integrated in our environment here. As you know, we're a fairly rural state. By the way, we have a lot of snow right now, so anybody that's thinking of skiing will be skiing here until May. Somebody just reminded me to pitch the tourism on your show here. But the FQHCs play a vital part of this whole sort of plan. And what we did is actually they were very instrumental in sort of drafting the marketing, the outreach program for us here in terms of bringing people in, because they see people uninsured every day. And actually are a key element in our marketing this plan. Remember, as I said in the beginning, we have, of the uninsured that we have, 50% of them are eligible for Medicaid, and they just haven't come onto our program yet. So we really reached out to the FQHCs, and secondly, what we did in sort of integrating them is the ability to market the Catamount Health Plan as well as we move forward. So they have actually become a very critical partner in this whole process with us.
Well, we have to wrap up the hour soon. I want to give each of you an opportunity for some final thoughts. And Mike Smith, let me ask you, you're in the thick of implementation now. Give us a sense, looking ahead, of what milestones to look for, what over the next couple of years should we expect to see happening in Vermont?
Well, October 1st, we go live. Susan Basayo, who is the person in charge of implementing, is really in the thick of things right now. So we're looking at that as we move forward. At the same time, we've got to keep an eye on fiscal stability as we move forward through this. I think what we're hinging our fiscal stability on is something that I just briefly touched on, is what is called the Blueprint for Health, which sort of turns our care delivery system upside down and looks at how do we become more proactive in those chronic diseases that are really driving the cost of healthcare here. And we have integrated in this state, because we're small, the hospital, the provider network, the docs, everybody into this process, and we're implementing, you know, technology to provide care management plans, diagnoses plans, those sort of things that we're banking on that will really drive the cost of insurance down, because right now we have an estimated 25% of Vermonters with chronic conditions that account for about 70% of the healthcare spending here in the state, and only about 55% of them get the right care at the right time. What the blueprint does, and what the chronic care model does, is really put that on its head and really go after it in terms of preventative, in terms of diagnostic, and in terms of care management after that. And we haven't spent a lot of time on that, but that's an integral part of what we're trying to do here in driving the increase in healthcare down. So that's sort of my final thought, and they have to go hand in hand as we move forward.
And do you feel you have the pieces in place to address chronic illness in that way, or do you think it'll take some further legislation or initiatives?
Well, actually, about half the bill dealt with this initiative, and it's tying in the health care plans throughout the state into this. Our Medicaid plan our Medicaid office, for example, has started to implement the programs for chronic disease management and for the blueprint. So we have a very active, and it's been great. I'm sure we're going to have bumps down the road, but we have a very active sort of collaborative team working with all the sort of interest groups to put this together. And at the same time, we have the infrastructure being built in terms of technology that will fit right into this.
Great. Richard Figueroa, I'm presuming you're not going live October 1st. But give us a sense over the next several months how the process you think is likely to play out in California. The proposals are now in the legislature. Give us a timeline of what you think might happen, what you hope to happen.
Yes. The governor's, in general, the governor's very, very committed to doing something this year. He came out with a proposal in January. The Democratic leader in the Assembly has his own proposal. The Democratic leader in the Senate has his own proposal. The minority Republicans in both houses have their proposal, and that's the first time, at least in my memory, that I've been doing this for 25 years now, that all four caucuses have a major proposal along with the governor. So that speaks very highly to how important the issue is on the agenda this year. We've been, over the last 3 weeks, having some smaller group sessions with legislative staff and some of the major stakeholders to kind of walk through our plan to help provide kind of a sounding board or a table from which to discuss all these major issues. Next week, the head of the Senate and Assembly, as well as the single payer bill, will be up in front of the legislature in their first policy committees. I would expect them all to be kind of voted out. The other major proposals besides the governor's all share a lot of common elements in terms of, trying to either do medical loss ratios on insurers or prevention of wellness. They all have major components of coverage. So there's lots of commonality in a lot of these different things. I think one of the big issues, of course, is going to be financing. And ours is set up in such a way, or constructed in such a way, that there's no impact on the state's general fund. All the dollars that are associated with the various revenue elements I discussed earlier go into a special fund to fund the coverage. And so funding is going to be a major issue, particularly, as I indicated before, there's a two-thirds vote requirement for revenues in California. So, the governor is going to be engaging the leadership of both parties in both houses to figure out what is the best way to set up this table, given that there are bills moving through the legislature at the same time we have our own proposal on the table, and what will that structure be? What will it look like? Our legislature leaves, in the early fall, and they are a full-time legislature, so we have a number of months to kind of complete our work this year, but the governor really does want to do something this year. It's just a matter of trying to, how do you set this table to deal with, which is a very large proposal on our part that includes the three elements I talked about earlier in a fashion that gives people a sense of, getting these issues to be aired completely, giving the public some input, and at the end of the day come out to be something that is implementable. I would note that we have benefited tremendously by the work of Vermont and Massachusetts and others that have come before us in trying to think about, how do you identify, or how do you define what affordability means? What are some of the elements of Medicaid expansions? What are some of the prevention and wellness kind of things that you can put on the table? So I'd also like to tip our hats to those who have come before us and helping us define these issues as we move forward.
And Phyllis, you get the last word here. We talked about the murkiness of ERISA. Any prospects for it becoming clearer anytime soon, or what will it take to, do you think, to clarify these issues?
Well, I think, I guess I don't want states thinking about these issues to be completely turned off by or discouraged by the Maryland decision, even though it is the first reported case. Because I think what it will take, if you're asking me if there's likely to be any federal clarification of this by Congress, I don't think so. I still have the scars on my back from our attempt in 1993 to get some clarification when I was on the congressional staff. But I think what it really will take is a number of states, important states, Vermont's already moved, Massachusetts has already moved, California, and I know a number of other states are thinking about this, to do comprehensive reform. Because I think the one thing we do learn about the Maryland court case is that it isn't going to work if you're just trying to do little bits and pieces, because then for sure you're going to get challenged. But if it's part of a comprehensive reform, I think that's what it's going to take for it to get clarification, for some one or series of states to do comprehensive reform with a part of an employer component of reform, and we'll see what happens.
And taking off your lawyer hat for a second and putting on
your policy hat,
I mean, you spent a long time on the Hill. Yeah. If states do move ahead with these kinds of comprehensive reforms, some of which may push the envelope of ERISA, does that put any pressure on Congress to do
anything? I surely hope so, because I don't think that the answer here is for every state to have to reinvent the wheel and do it. This is a national problem. The escalating cost question, the uninsured problems, these are all national problems. And if we had a commitment on the federal legislative level to do something about these problems, and the states wouldn't feel like they had to do this step by step, state by state.
Well, thank you. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. We'll see you next time for Elements of State Health Reform, when we'll be discussing the issue of how to finance coverage expansions.